Welcome to the Montefiore Einstein Health Technology Innovation Podcast Series. Today, we'll be playing a previous recording from an Innovation Biodesign Seminar.
So first, I'd love to introduce Dr. Craig Kineski, who's a patent attorney ahead of the life science practice at WSGR in New York. Craig's practice focuses on taking small life science companies from startup to exit, building an IP estate, and improving the outcomes of technology-driven business deals. Craig regularly works with university spinouts to obtain licenses to valuable technology and to transform laboratory data into an investable company. Craig was trained as an organic, bioorganic, and computational chemist. Craig teaches a class at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City on how to start, pitch, and finance a successful life science company. Craig is also an investor in early-stage life science companies and is active in the angel community. So Craig, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Certainly. Thank you for having me. And may I share my screen?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Do you have a good view of that?
Looks great. Thanks.
All right, great. Well, thank you for inviting me to assist in this health tech innovation seminar. And we're going to talk about some high-level intellectual property topics that are really going to impact the value of a health tech innovation. So first, just a brief overview. Let's talk about the main categories of intellectual property. And really the one that matters most here when we're talking about anything in the life science world, anything in the health world, is the patent. The patent is what gives you the exclusive right to use and commercialize your technology. It keeps other people out. And that's where the value lies. Keeping other people out makes your venture, your technology, more valuable to potential business partners, more valuable to companies who might want to come along and acquire your venture someday. There are other forms of intellectual property, but they tend not to create value in bio or medical related startups nearly to the level that patents do. For example, trade secrets are a form of intellectual property. This is something that only your company knows that gives you a competitive advantage. They're great at first because really your company is probably built on a trade secret. Your initial technology idea is going to be a trade secret for a little while. Over the course of a new venture, trade secrets get out in the public, and that's okay. You don't have to try to stop that from happening. That's just what happens. So the value of things being secret, it quickly diminishes over time. Copyright is something that you'll hear about when looking at printed matter like computer code, which is really the only way that it relates to health technology, computer code. Copyright gives you what I like to call a head start advantage in that it stops a competitor from bulk copying the code underlying your application and reusing it. But it doesn't stop anybody from coding a whole new app that does the same thing as your healthcare technology does. You need a patent to stop somebody from writing completely different code that gets the same healthcare outcome as your product does. And that's why the patent is important. And finally, trademarks. When you buy something at the store and you see that little R in a circle on the package, that is an indication of who is the manufacturer of the product. And in the early stages, that's really not so important. Once you get out there and you're targeting consumers, then the value of trademarks really increase. But in the early stage, when you are trying to improve the value of this venture to investors and business partners, trademarks really don't have an effect on that. Patents are what do that. And what we're really thinking about here, I work with life science startups in all life science sectors, be it health tech, med tech, virtual health, pharmaceuticals, biotech. And one thing is true among all of them. The main driver of the value of the venture is its intellectual property. And by that, I mean its patents. The patents are really what determine the strength of the company and get investors interested, because that means you can keep competitors out and have something like a little monopoly, at least for a short while. This will get you better transactions. It will get you better valuations. And the trick is, when you go into negotiations with investors, when you go into diligence, you need to know in advance what they're looking for. So you can have a prepackaged venture already set up for exactly the kind of thing they're looking to invest in. So you get that strategy going ahead of time and come in the door with something that is frontline investable. Whereas every day of the week, investors are being bombarded with companies that need to be told where they have to be investable. We want the IP strategy to be ready. As soon as you walk into the door of the investor, show them, look, I've got a portfolio, I've got an IP plan for the next 5 years, and that's why you should believe in what we're doing. You might have compatriots who work in high tech who might tell you that patents really aren't worth paying for. And if you hear that, it's probably because in high tech, well, there's some truth to that. In social media, in aerospace, in computer engineering, patents are not what drive value. But when we're talking about healthcare, when we're talking about anything related to medicine, patents are really what determine the value of the technology. So let's talk a little bit about patents. So what is a patent? A patent is a privilege that you're granted by the government that gives you the ability to stop other people from making, using, selling, or importing your technology into the United States for about 20 years from the day that you first submit your patent application to the patent office. And this is a deal you're making with the patent office. In exchange for this exclusive privilege to commercialize my technology, I'm going to let the patent office publish that technology, so the world gets to see the benefit of my technology advancement. So that's the cost of seeking the patent, that you do have to put some information out there. And once you've got that patent, others cannot use your technology in the United States or other countries that we'll talk about later without either getting your permission or without taking you to court and going through a big expensive legal battle to try to defeat your patent. Rest assured, any patent that relates to a successful life science product will end up challenged someday. So you really need to start getting the proper guidance on day one, because what you do right or wrong on day one will determine the value of this technology 5, 8, even 12 years down the road. The question I get asked all the time by people in all fields of technology, but especially in health tech, is, what can I patent? Can I really patent this stuff? And the answer is that if you have the right strategy, there isn't much that you cannot patent in med tech, health tech, or life science. It really comes down to strategy. And the things that you can patent, the scope of technology that is protectable by patent, it's probably just about anything that you would do in this field. It could be a medical device. It could be a consumer product. If you ask a lot of IP attorneys, they might tell you that you can't get a patent on a diagnostic or on medical software or on some kind of diagnostic software program. And I'm here to tell you that's not true. You absolutely can obtain patent protection on diagnostics, on software. The key is, and this is why people think you can't get patents on these things, is the patent office doesn't care about what code you write. They care a lot about how your code, how your app, how your health tech achieves a medical outcome. What is the medical outcome based on your healthcare technology? What is the interface between the technology and the patient or the user? That's where the intellectual property is. And if you can protect that, you will have a patent that will prevent people, even people who use other code, even people who write other code to get the same medical outcome that you got. You can keep them off the market too. And that's super valuable, because it's one thing to maintain exclusivity from people who are going to copy your product. It's a much better thing to be able to maintain exclusivity over people who will do something a little bit different. And that's what the patent gives you the ability to do. So now we're going to talk a little bit about prior art, which is probably the most important thing you'll deal with in the patenting process, where really you will be able to use your academic understanding of technology to help advance the process. So patentability, what do you need to get a patent? So to get a patent, you need a technology that is novel, and that's as simple as it sounds. You cannot have published the technology already. And it's non-obvious. Now, non-obvious is a lawyer jargon word that your lawyer is going to use every time they talk to you, and your lawyer is never going to explain what it means. And what it means in simple terms is your technology has never been published anywhere exactly the way you've described it in your patent application. But there's some other patent application out there. There's some other journal article out there that describes a technology that's pretty darn close to yours. So the patent office will write you a letter saying, I found this other technology that's pretty darn close to yours, but not quite the same thing. Explain to me why your technology is different or better than what I found in this other piece of literature. And that piece of literature is called prior art. This is another term that your lawyer is going to use all the time. Prior art is any information that is out there in the public before you file your patent application that is pretty darn close to the technology that you're trying to protect. And how do we deal with prior art? We deal with prior art ideally by having really good data or really good beta testing on the system that you developed. You want to be able to go to the patent office, or the patent office writes you a letter, saying, I searched for prior art. I found this piece of prior art. I think it looks a lot like the thing that you talk about in your patent application. Convince me that I'm wrong. The easiest way to convince the patent examiner that they're wrong is to write back and say, look, I tested my product. Here are my beta test results. Look how well it worked. This is just better than what's out there. That's the story you want to be able to tell to the patent office. So what can be prior art? Well, really anything that's out there in the public before you file your patent application. Almost all prior art that the patent office finds when it does its literature search is either old journal articles or old patents, but it can be anything that's out there. It can be something that's on a website. It can be something that was on a poster that was presented at a conference. It can be an abstract from a book of abstracts that ended up online. It can be something from your own research laboratory's website. So definitely be mindful of what you put out there in the public domain before you decide that you want to patent something. So how do we deal with prior art? Well, we have a tool for that, and that's called a provisional patent application. You write something up to the patent office. Basically, you take your technology, write it up, send it into the patent office. Even if you're not really ready to get a patent, you haven't worked out all the bells and whistles, you write up a technology disclosure and send it to the patent office, and that plants a flag in the sand. And what that means is, from this day forward, from the day that I sent my provisional patent application to the patent office, anything that gets published by anyone from this day forward is not prior art. So that protects us. That's how we get our foot in the door and is our first step towards getting a patent. And it doesn't have to be a completed, finalized, lawyered up patent application. A provisional patent application can be anything. It can be a copy of a journal manuscript. It can be seminar slides. It doesn't have to be something that you paid a lawyer $10,000 to do. It can be something that the technical team completely wrote up on their own and your lawyer filed at the patent office for you. In fact, If you do want to publish a journal article on technology and you're afraid that the journal article is going to hurt your ability to get a patent, you just take your journal manuscript, give it to the lawyer, and tell the lawyer, take this journal manuscript and file it as a provisional patent application. There's no reason you can't do that. If you're giving a seminar next week, you can print out your seminar slides, give them to the patent attorney, and have the attorney file a provisional patent application that is just a copy of your seminar slides. Then you're safe to go present whatever you want, and it won't be prior art, and you won't have to face it when you're before the patent examiner. What goes in a provisional? Anything that you want. Any scientific concepts, any technical diagrams, any kind of data or tests that you've run, but most importantly, anything that you want to protect, anything that you plan to publish, and anything that you plan to show to an investor. Now we're going to talk just a little bit about the timeline for patenting, because I know we're getting close to the end of my time. A patent survives for about 20 or 21 years from the day that the patent application is filed. The more time you have left in the patent, the more it is worth. Because what a lot of investors do when they determine the valuation of your company is they look at the term of your patents and they calculate the net present value of your market out until the day that your longest term patent expires. So the more time you have in a patent, the greater is the net present value of that product. And in all probability, the greater is the valuation of your venture. Now, here's what the timeline looks like to get a patent. You file this provisional patent application and it lives for 1 year in the patent office. During that year, you can revise, edit, update, improve, run experiments, come up with new designs, do whatever you want with that provisional patent application to make it as good as you want it to be. At the end of that year, you have to commit to something, and that is filing patent applications in the United States and potentially internationally. So you will file a United States non-provisional patent application. That'll sit in the patent examiner's desk for about a year and a half before it finally gets into negotiation with a patent examiner. And after about three or three and a half years, it will result ideally in an issued patent that will protect your technology. You're not done there. You can then start the process all over again and try to get another patent, and then a third patent, and a fourth patent. You could get any number of United States patents out of a single United States provisional patent application. And in many industries, they do that. You'll also want to think about whether you want to protect yourself internationally. In the life science world, investors really like to see patent protection in Europe, Japan, and China. Those are thought of as the top three geographies for intellectual property value. So we'll file an international patent application. And a year and a half later, then we have to commit to what specific countries we'd like to have patent protection in. And big venture capital funds, they want to see at least Europe, Japan, and China. Now, you could accelerate this process by paying the patent office a pretty substantial fee to get your patent in about a year and a half instead of about three or three and a half years. $5,000 to make that go faster is sometimes a lot to chew on for an early stage venture, but investors would rather see an issued patent than a patent application. So if money is no object, you would want to pay to accelerate. And here is what a patent portfolio may look like over time. By first patent family, I mean the provisional patent application and every United States and non-United States patent that arose from that provisional patent application. That's usually the description of the seminal technology. Sometimes it comes from a university, and sometimes it's getting old by the time you get around to commercializing. And if it is getting old, its value might be diminishing because it's going to give you a smaller net present value. So what you need is an updated patent family that's going to describe your second generation product or an improvement or the real commercial embodiment of whatever was in that original, seminal, possibly academic patent application. That's going to stretch out that timeline and improve the value of your venture, because that's really what we're trying to do here, get you a better valuation on your technology venture. Then maybe, depending on what you're doing, you might have additional patent families in the future. If you have a platform technology that has many uses, many applications, in the future, you may file many patent applications on its various uses. It's very common that people do this in pharma and biotech. If you've got a health tech or a virtual health product that has multiple uses, you do that here too. If you've got a consumer product that will run its course in 8 or 10 years, then you probably won't file patent applications in the future. And one final note, freedom to operate. This is something you'll think about as you get deeper into the venture. Does anyone else have a patent that can block your venture from commercializing your product? Because if they do, they might be able to stop you. And we have to think prospectively about this and know where those problems are, because investors will ask. And if we find a problem out there by doing a patent search, we try to resolve it either by getting a license to that patent that's causing problems for us, maybe tweaking our design a little bit so that third-party patent isn't a problem, or if that patent is getting old, we just postpone our launch a little bit and wait for that third-party patent to expire. And that's a little primer on IP and how it can improve the value of health tech ventures. And I look forward to answering any questions during the Q&A session.
Thanks so much, Craig. That was absolutely amazing. So we appreciate it. And thanks for your support of our innovation program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. And I'd now like to introduce Jason Johnson. So Jason Johnson is a partner in the healthcare privacy and cybersecurity and IP practice groups at Moses & Singer LLP. Jason focuses practice on the legal aspects of digital health innovation, the privacy and security of data under U.S. European laws, and the complex regulatory and compliance issues facing biotech or among digital health companies. Prior to joining Moses & Singer, Jason was a patent litigator in the chemical and pharmaceutical industry and has substantial experience in counseling clients regarding patent portfolio development and management. In his pre-law life, Jason was a benchtop scientist conducting research at both academic medical centers and pharmaceutical companies. Jason acts as a mentor for startup biotech, pharma, and digital health companies, using his practical experience as a scientist and a lawyer to help companies grow their ideas into a business. Thanks so much, Jason. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sunit. And can you hear me okay?
It's great. Thank you.
Good. It's a new pair of headphones for Christmas, so just making sure they still work okay. I'm going to share my screen now. So I'm going to go through regulatory issues that we often see for digital health companies. And so this will be the gamut of medical device entities, as well as digital health apps, and anything and everything in between. And so the first thing I'm going to start off with is privacy related issues, because as I'm sure most of you are aware, there are a lot of companies out there that their whole business model is built off of the collection of user information, like Facebook. And so so even though companies like Facebook may not seem relevant to you and what you're doing, they absolutely are. And so, you know, we do a lot of work with digital health and health tech startups. And one of the main misconceptions that we run into for folks that haven't gone through the process before is that, particularly in the healthcare space, is that they believe that, well, if HIPAA doesn't cover me, then we're good and we don't have to worry about anything else. Unfortunately, that is not the case of the situation when it comes to privacy issues. On top of the HIPAA-related issues that you may run into if you're collecting PHI or if you're working with an academic medical center to help populate the data in your app, there are various state laws and regulations that you would have to worry about, because those laws are drafted very broadly and would cover the same information that you may be collecting through the health app that you have. And to the extent you have data that you're collecting that perhaps is not HIPAA covered as part of the robust data collection or data set that you have, then those state laws would kick in even though they're not covered under HIPAA. So first and foremost, whenever you're coming up with the idea, it's really important to look at the data flows, where the data you think is going to come from. Is it going to come from web sources? Is it going to come from the individual user of the technology, or is it going to come from a third party? And once you've mapped that data, then you can go through and determine and make sure, well, other than HIPAA, do I have to think about state laws and regulations? New York in particular has a very stringent laws when it comes to genetic privacy. And so, again, depending on the type of data that you have, there are genetic privacy laws across the 50 states that you would have to worry about. So, again, understanding what data you're going to get and where you're going to get it from is going to be very important. Along those same lines, which is in line with the slide I had before, is the consent issue. So, again, when we're talking about state laws and regulations, there are multiple states that require not only appropriate disclosure, but obtaining consent for the collection and use of certain types of information. So again, whenever you're in the development stage, it's going to be important to understand where those meets and bounds are, because you want to make sure that you're making the appropriate disclosures to the individual and you're getting the proper consents. Because the worst case scenario for you is that you've collected all this data and it turns out you haven't collected it appropriately. So that will definitely minimize the value that you have in the data set. And you do not want to have to go back and try to recollect consents. That's just not operationally going to be feasible for you most of the way. The other data flow issue to think about, again, outside of the direct patient collection information, is, are you receiving information from third parties? So for example, are you coming up with a technology or innovation that will integrate, say, lab results to help either for diagnostic or treatment purposes? Well, again, under some state laws, you may not be able to directly receive the lab result from the lab. You may have to get that either from the patient or from the physician. So again, when you're thinking through design of the data flow and design of the app, it will be important to consider what data other than pure health information data are you going to be getting, and are there state laws that may prevent you from directly obtaining those, or will you have to come up with an alternative mechanism to make sure that they can be part of the data set you collect and part of the way that you want your health app or your digital health flow to work. And finally, vendors, in a lot of instances, you won't be either hosting your own data, or you may be using third parties to help you develop the software or to host the apps. Generally speaking, if you as the entity have an obligation under, say, HIPAA or a state law, you're going to have to push down those same obligations onto your vendors. In today's day and age, I feel like there are vendors kind of everywhere. It's its own startup industry. And so what it becomes really important is that you do appropriate due diligence on these vendors to make sure that you're partnering with the right entity. Again, the worst thing that you can happen is you work with a startup, data center, and they don't have appropriate procedures in place to protect the data, and then you have a data breach. And so now at the very beginning of your venture, you've had a data breach, you're losing confidence not only from the folks that you want to try to get on board to use your app, but now you've got potential liability because your vendor has allowed a data breach to occur. So it is important to think about who you're working with. There are some bigger players out there like Amazon Web Services and other folks like that, which are maybe more expensive, but are probably more reliable. And so it will be a balance and a business risk, right? Because I do know that all you guys are all funding is an issue. And so, but regardless of who you pick, due diligence is going to be very important, along with certain contractual terms. You're going to want to make sure that you've locked them in to certain standards and that they are going to notify you and work with you as necessary to make sure that if they do have a data breach or you need access to the data, that you have the appropriate rights to do that. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of you will probably work in either directly with physicians or medical centers to collect PHI. So HIPAA may already be on your radar, but obviously HIPAA compliance is going to be an issue not only for yourself, but also for the vendors that you use. So the vendor issue will come up there again. The other interesting thing that comes up quite often is that When you work with hospitals or physician practices, you may be asked to sign a business associate agreement right away to be able to get access to the data. It is important to know whether or not you are someone's business associate or whether or not you are just getting access to the data itself and not acting as a business associate. A business associate is an entity that will in and of itself be assisting the covered entity, in this case, the physician or the medical center, right? So you're going to be helping them in the treatment or diagnosis of the individual patient. If the only thing that you're doing is getting access to patient data records and you're not providing that information back or any type of service back to the covered entity or to the medical center, then you may not be a business associate. So again, it's important to think that issue through because signing a business associate agreement does tie you directly to HIPAA and protecting the data under HIPAA. And you may be able to avoid that if you're not actually acting as a business associate. outside of the U.S., we've worked with multiple ventures where they are trying to work with international medical centers, particularly over in Europe. In Europe, there is a law or a regulation called the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. Some of you may have heard of that. And that's a very strict regime on privacy. And so if you're going to go into the international market, GDPR is likely going to become very familiar in your vernacular. And it's a very tough regulation to deal with because it requires a lot of disclosure to the individual for the collection use of the information. And there are obligations on the back end to delete or get rid of information once you've finished your purpose of using it. So again, that is something that may come into your radar as you move internationally. Unfortunately, or it just depends on how you look at it, unfortunately for businesses, a lot of countries are picking up GDPR and implementing laws and regulations that are very similar. So even though Europe was sort of the epicenter of this, it's definitely occurring in more and more countries. And so you're going to run into more than likely more and more strict privacy laws if you go outside of the U.S. In the U.S., just to back up, there's the most stringent state law right now is in California, the California Consumer Privacy Act, or CCPA. And so there is a carve out there for HIPAA-covered information. So you may be able, again, to, if you're compliant with HIPAA, avoid some other law or legal requirements. But again, it's going to be important that you think through what your vendors are and your business model before you start taking on these obligations, because it can be difficult in some instances to make sure that you comply. As far as data breaches go, again, state laws have very strict, in some cases, obligations on who you have to notify and when, depending on what the data breach is. So whatever you're subject to, you're going to need to make sure that you have appropriate internal policies and procedures to make sure that notifications occur appropriately. And the same thing under HIPAA. You're going to want to make sure that you're ready and prepared for a data breach. One interesting thing to note is that even though there's not a federal privacy law, the Federal Trade Commission, or the FTC, does enforce on the federal level. And recently, in the last several years, where it has been enforcing has actually been on privacy policies and privacy notices, not necessarily in the health tech field, but they have gone after companies who have not provided appropriate disclosure regarding the collection or use of information to individuals. And the FTC has used their power to come after companies in that way. One of the things that HIPAA did, along with some of the amendments to it, including the high tech, was this idea of allowing an individual patient to basically have their electronic records at their fingertips. Right, you can take your PHI with you anywhere you want to. And so there was a thought that there were going to be a lot of companies that would come into this space, right? So they're not HIPAA-covered entities because they would work directly with the individual, right? So they're not performing any type of medical services, but they would house all this protected health information in a format for the individual. So the FTC decided that they wanted to ensure that for those entities that even though they weren't covered by HIPAA, someone was going to hold them accountable. So the FTC came out with what they called the health breach notification rule in the early 2000s. And so what this covered were at the time was the vendors of personal health records and related entities. So again, at that time, before sort of the digital health explosion, the focus really was on vendors that were going to create ways for people to take their personal health records around with them. Last year, seeing sort of the explosion of the digital health space, the FTC has asked folks, well, how can we expand this rule to cover all these new digital health companies that exist out there, right? Because now we have people that are not necessarily, vendors of just PHI to allow people to take their data around, but they're collecting all kinds of personal health information, but they're not HIPAA-covered entities. So it's likely that in the next several years, you're going to see more enforcement from the federal government when it comes to digital health apps as they move into this space to try to protect people's information that are collected, not necessarily, again, to PHI, but any and all digital health records. So we're still waiting to see where that's going to end up, but that is one thing to keep an eye on as you build out your app and your data set, is whether or not you're going to be subject potentially to FTC breach notification rules. And then finally, with enforcement, again, as I mentioned before, the FTC has come after companies in the last several years for privacy policies and state attorney generals as well. So in New York, actually, a couple of years back, the state attorney general of New York filed suits against three digital health companies. And again, the focus of those digital health companies were all based on their privacy policy. One of the digital health companies was a cardiac company. And so what they did was they would collect EKGs from their wristwatch. And then it would give the individual, information about, okay, your pulse is 80 degrees or 80 beats per minute. So, you must be stressed or you're active. And so the attorney general was really came after these companies, not because of the way that they were giving information out to the user, but the fact that they were collecting and using this information from people for a completely different purpose on the back end. They were apparently selling the data to third parties. And so, again, going back to the consent and disclosure aspect of this, that's really going to be important, is that you want to make sure that you've provided the appropriate disclosure to individuals that are using your app to let them know this is what we're going to collect, this is what we're going to use with it. And as long as you're accurate and forthright, then you shouldn't have any issues with that. And so in addition to just the privacy issues, there's obviously a regulatory component to this, right? Particularly when you're in the digital health space. And so the FDA comes up quite often in this, and what we usually see in this digital health space is software as a medical device, right? And so, the first concept to really think about, which will help kind of guide which direction you think you're going to go, is: are you in digital health or are you in digital medicine? And so, the distinction between digital health and digital medicine is really one of treatment, I would say. So in the digital medicine realm, what you're actually doing is partner with an entity that you're looking to provide actual medical advice. So you're trying to intervene in someone's health or health aspect, right? Whereas in the digital health space, what you're more doing is you're more passive. So you're collecting and storing data for folks. And you're really just, it's more of a lifestyle wellness type of app that you have or type of device that you have, right? So not really trying to diagnose or treat per se, but you're collecting information and giving back feedback to let folks know what's going on. And so between the two, digital medicine, when you get into the treatment area, that's going to be more regulated than the digital health space. And so if you find yourself trying to figure out which direction you want to go and you want to avoid the FDA, thinking about whether or not you want to be a digital health or a digital medicine entity is going to be important, because if you're in the digital health space, you're less likely to be regulated by the FDA, whereas if you're in the digital medicine space, you're more likely to be regulated. And that regulation comes in the form of software as a medical device in most cases, right? So again, We're going to avoid just pure medical devices that have interventional purposes, but we're going to focus on where there's a software component that is part of the actual medical device. And so you see the definition here. And again, I think bottom line is if the software is performing a task where you're helping to do either in the diagnosis or the treatment, then you're more toward the software as a medical device side, and you're more likely to be regulated by the FDA. These are all things, though, that you should work with a regulatory counsel on at the outset, because getting FDA approval is sometimes time intensive and not very inexpensive. And so you want to make sure that you've appropriately identified yourself and you have a plan. Because otherwise, if you're scrambling at the last minute to try to come up with an FDA submission because you realize now that you are going to be regulated by the FDA, that will be very difficult. I think I heard one of the innovation fellows talking about AI and machine learning as part of what their idea was. And, you know, AI is obviously becoming ubiquitous in the health space, both from a data mining perspective as well as in the sort of the digital medicine space. And so AI is a very, and machine learning is a very tough, interesting area for the FDA. So last year, the FDA put out this paper asking for thoughts about how is it that we can actually regulate AI and machine learning software in the medical device space, right? Because if you think about it from the FDA's perspective, what the FDA cares about when it approves a medical device is that, is it going to do the same thing consistently and output the same result, right? Because it needs to be consistent. You can't have inconsistency in a medical device because then you may have, you know, poor outcomes, right? So a lot of what the clinical work that you do is to prove that things are you know, reproducible and is consistent. AI obviously learns, right? And so what the AI software spits out today may be completely different than what the AI software spits out 6 months from now, because it's learned a lot. So, you know, the FDA may have approved software as a medical device based on X output and Y reproducibility, but that may be changing now. So how does the FDA keep up with this? And so it turns out, actually, a couple of days ago, the FDA released their plan to make a plan, so to speak. And so it looks like the FDA is going to have standards for updating and along the way. And so maybe some pre-approval certifications and things like that. So it's very interesting to see the FDA go through this. But again, it's going to be very important that if you've got AI as part of your device and you think you're going to fall in the software as a medical device, that you definitely talk with the regulatory council sooner rather than later. And then there's a couple of exceptions. Again, if you're looking to see whether or not you fall outside the FDA scope, there's a clinical decision software support carve out, which is part of the Cures Act several years back. And so again, if the software that you have is really just it's just reading. And it's not there for treatment or diagnosis. It's really just supporting, X-ray reading or things like that. Then that probably would meet the support software carve out. And then again, general wellness products are just not FDA regulated. And so I think you see a lot of those out there. But again, the important thing is you just want to make sure that you've properly thought this through and you've got a plan to address all these things. And so finally, in our COVID world, which is still ongoing, in the short term, at least during the pandemic, there have been several regulatory changes that have occurred. And the reason I bring these up is that it is important to know, understand that whether or not you are currently relying on or working within the scope of an exception or perhaps current pause in enforcement in the activities that you're undertaking. The reason that's important is that it's a little bit unclear whether or not some of these COVID changes that occurred in the pandemic are actually going to continue. So for example, OCR announced that they were going to provide enforcement discretion for potential HIPAA violations for telehealth providers. And so what they did was is they came out with a list of, you know, technology platforms that they thought were safe and that could be used during the pandemic, right? And so if you're in the telehealth space and you're relying on a third-party software program, it may be that, yes, now you are okay, but you may not be okay in the future because they may not have, you know, the HIPAA-required security or rule requirements or privacy rule requirements. And so so it is important to, again, going back to the vendor side, know what who you're working with now and understand whether or not you're currently working within the scope of an exception. And if you are, what is your plan in the future? And the same thing with the state practice laws, state practice of medicine laws, because everyone is working virtually and remotely. Again, you may have access to individuals who are able to perform actions currently on your platform or to assist in actions on your platform, but in the future, they may not be able to. And again, if you're relying on the relaxation in the state practice of medicine laws, then again, you want to make sure that you've got everything covered on the back end, because if you lose those practitioners as part of whatever it is your digital innovation is, then and you know you want to make sure that you know how to appropriately address that. And so that is all that I had. And
great. Thank you so much, Jason. That was incredible. So really appreciate your help, your support for taking the time. And I would now like to introduce Sylvia Garcia-Cadoni. So Sylvia is an entrepreneur and former life sciences executive with over 20 years of experience in medical devices and digital health. She's the founder and CEO of Mira Therapeutics, a digital health startup helping people recover from trauma and PTSD through self-management and measurement-based care. Mira just released her first product, the Mira app, this December. Before Mira Therapeutics, Sylvia held several leadership roles, including startups in medical devices and digital health, and across disciplines such as cardiology, plastic surgery, diabetes, and electronic medical records. Sylvia is originally from Europe, moved to the States years ago to build the US affiliate for a European medical device company. She has worked in sales and business development, has a technical background in clinical regulatory affairs, and holds an MSc in mathematics and an MBA from IE Business School. Thank you so much, Sylvia, for joining us.
Thank you, Sunit, for the invite, and I hope that I can share some experiences that will be useful to people that are hearing here. So I'm going to share my screen. My presentation is a little different from what we have seen more, from the other two speakers. So what I'm trying to get to share today is some of the things that kind of learn through being an entrepreneur and also bit from before having been in life sciences for quite a number of years. So I hope you would enjoy it and that we can have a good discussion at the end. So I decided to go from idea to product because this is, I think, where we are all kind of starting. First, Sunit already said quite a lot of what I've been doing, so I will not repeat myself. So I have spent a number of years in life sciences and now I'm an entrepreneur. So I wanted to just take a moment to tell you what Mira is because I'm gonna use it for some of the description of things. So it will give some of the context. So we are a digital health startup helping people recover from trauma and PTSD. We were founded in 2019 and we had the first product live, which is our Mira app, is a mobile app in December. So what we do with the Mira app is to provide the tools for self-management. So when symptoms occur, people can get in two taps of their phone to some help that helps themselves to get grounded and move on with a normal day instead of falling into further consequences. The other thing we do is to help them track in real time what's happening and use this data both to for themselves to understand what's going on and to feed it to our next product, which is the MiraView, that would be for therapists. And that's where we can optimize and personalize treatment. So everything starts with an idea. Now, the problem with an idea is that in and of itself doesn't have any value. And it doesn't have any value because it's first when you have bring it to be something that has a, that is a business and it has a team and it exists, that you actually get value. So even the IP, the patents and so, I think there is a difference between thinking that the idea has value or the patent has value. The patent has value because it protects your idea, but the idea itself doesn't get really valuable until you have executed on it and you have a business on it. So when you with say that is then, so what, do I need a business plan, this thick document? And I would say, no, if what you're thinking is, do you need a 100-page document? That's not what you need. But you certainly need to know the answers to those questions, right? Is what is the problem that you're solving? For who is your customer? And then also what we were talking about before, what are the approvals and regulations that you would need to go through to get there? So what's gonna take? And the other part is how you're gonna make money. Because any business would need to make money. Otherwise, it will not succeed, right? Then those are the questions that you answer in a business plan. Therefore, do you need one? Yes. Do you need a 100-page document? No. And I would say even the basics to those questions, for me, were three of them. One is what is the problem you solve? So sometimes the idea is something like, I'm gonna make it easier to collaborate, or for the physician to know what's happening. You need to solve a problem because that is what gets people to use your solutions, to use your product. So it has been very helpful for me to think about what problem are we solving? So for us in Mira, we are solving the problem of people having a symptom and being alone and not really having a way to go or do anything. So solving that problem is valuable to them. But kind of, you know, getting information about trauma, for example, is not in and of itself. Because it doesn't solve a problem. The other thing is, who is your customer? And that might seem obvious in some cases, but I think in healthcare has many components because many of the things we do ultimately benefit a patient or somebody suffering from a condition. But this person may or may not be the ultimate customer. It is a customer in the sense that they need to use our products. So we still need to solve a problem for them. Otherwise they don't use it. On the other hand, they might not be the people actually paying, which is typically the question that defines who is the customer. And the who pays is important because if that, the person or entity that pays is the one that pays to get the problem solved. So if the problem you're solving is not the one for the person that's going to pay, you have this conundrum and you are serving somebody who is not actually your customer. I think one of the things for us was when I'm talking about Mira, so some people ask me, well, why would you start with the app and going direct to consumer with the app, which is actually what we're doing? Why you don't go to insurance or why you don't go to therapist to actually offer the app? And those are actually revenue models and sources that we are seeing over time. And we are seeing different ways to do that. But ultimately, we have a product that people need to use in order to actually provide value. So the first step for us is to have solve a problem for somebody, for the ultimate user. And therefore, because that is the user, we started saying, well, the first thing to do is that it's valuable for them. And if it's valuable for them, they would want to have a subscription for that. And then we can see how we expand and provide more value to the other shareholders that could bring other sources of revenue. One other thing that I found to be a important mandatory step is the customer discovery, is talking to customers. And talking to customers, not so much as to what do you want, but more as understanding what are their problems, understanding why they would care about my solution or somebody else's solution. And that is something that is especially hard when you come from a world of academics or from a world that is more on a lab or on your office, because it requires that you go out and you actually talk to people. But you know, we discover some interesting things. Like, for example, when you look at mental health in general, there is a lot about doing mindfulness and building a skills and all that. And all that is important. But many of our customers told us that, well, the problem is when I'm alone and I'm having a symptom, what I want is something that helps me get back on track. And so I don't run into a big spiral and have a lot of many more consequences. Granted, this is not like the therapy and I'm then cured if I can do that, but it is what's really helping me in a day-to-day basis. So I have, this is one of my pain points. This is one of my problems. And understanding that is what allows you to, or what allow us to actually modify where we were going with our product and decide what to put in it and what not to put in it. Which actually is kind of what's the concept of the minimum viable product. And the minimum viable product has the problem that it can always get bigger, right? So when we think about what should be our product or our solution, we can think of 1,000 features that could go in there. And if we wait to implement them all, well, first of all, we probably get wrong half of them, unless we have really vetted with customers. Or the other part is that by the time we are there, we need a lot of resources and it might be even too late. So how we get to that? So one of the things that help or help us was to iterate and to start a smaller, start with a group, check out a version, with it a alpha version, check it with a few people, then we iterated, then we did a better version that it was only on Android, and collect feedback, collect usage, see that actually we could get people engaged and using it. And then we say, okay, now we think we have enough that we can make the full version in both iPhone and Android. And so now we'd see if we got it right, but that's how we are moving along, as kind of a step by step. And it's okay to iterate, and it's okay to be nimble about changing the direction, so that you don't get a very big product that costs a lot, and then you need to backtrack. Of course, it's a bit different for everything, right? Because I have also had many years in medical devices where, well, you need to get it also to a certain stage that the device does work. Otherwise, why would you go through all the regulatory if it's not good enough? But in a way, it also applies this idea
does the virus is higher. I wanted to put a note about sales and marketing because oftentimes, well, all the time we get asked, you know, what is your marketing plan? And how, what is your marketing plan? And ultimately the question, I would like to rephrase it a little bit more like, how are you going to reach your customers without breaking the bank? And how and who are they? And you only know how you reach them if you know who they are and where to find them. So really, this is what is the question. And especially in health tech, a lot of it can be like, oh, I'm going to do social media. But social media is super crowded. And just saying that is not going to get anywhere. And you need to be much more specific than that. Like, this is the type of people I'm going to reach. This is how I'm going to reach it. Or I have targeted this and that type of influencers, or I'm going to do advertisement or whatever I'm going to do. And I have found very hard to even explain that in a convincing way. So the most convincing part ultimately ends up being, well, we have been doing social media and we have so many followers, or we have so many people who have signed up for our app. So ultimately seeing that conversion, it can be what you ultimately need to have, but having the plan and the understanding of where you're going to get it and where you're going to get the customers is extremely important. And I have found it to be much harder to get to that answer than it may seem. Well, a couple of additional things that are maybe a little bit more general. And one is about getting advice. So pretty much any question that you have, and you have tons of them while trying to build a company or a product, you can get oftentimes opposite answers to it and opposite advice. And it's not because people, one is wrong and the other one is right. It's probably one of them is might be wrong for you, or maybe both are wrong for you, or maybe both are right for you. It really depends on where this is coming from. So understanding why people tell you one thing or the other is even more important. And ultimately, you will need to decide. And that's also okay, because you are the person who know best about your business and your product. So you know all the details. So you have all the information to be able to make the decision, when somebody who would give you advice might not have it unless you actually give it to them. So an example is what we were discussing before on the IP, that I have gotten the advice both of absolutely not going for a patent because it was a waste of money, and the opposite, that I absolutely should get a patent and I should get more than one if I can. So again, even in something that one would think is pretty straightforward on one answer, it wasn't. And the other one would be focus and priorities. Obviously, your biggest problem is your time, because that's the scarcest resources of all. And you will need to prioritize what actually gives value to your company, whatever that is. Sometimes at some point it's going to be, for example, getting that patent on, or getting the regulatory strategy so you know where to go. But many other times it will also be getting customers, or getting the product out, or it can be different depending on the time. But the guiding tool is, what does make the company more valuable or the product more valuable. And the other part is to execute. I think it's very easy to end up kind of analyzing and planning and planning and analyzing and planning again and analyzing again and trying to build this and that feature. But ultimately, the how do you show progress? How do you show that this is moving forward? Even if you don't have the resources, what can you then do with those resources? If you cannot acquire customers because you still don't have a product, well, can you get a waiting list? If you need another 3 months to finish some of the features of the product, well, can you start doing a little test with the ones that you have that shows that people are interested? Or can you show the other ones in a mock-up so you can see that people like it? Whatever you can do to show that you are advancing and that you are executing, that is not just something on a piece of paper, because people will talk to you once, they see that this piece of paper and the plans and everything is great, but then 3 months later, they want to see that you have actually done something on that plan. And that is for any of the stakeholders and absolutely most and foremost for investors. And I would say also the execution part is also to link it to what we were discussing on regulatory and things. Know what you are against, what you need to comply with, rather whether it's the privacy laws or whether it's your regulatory. You need to know what is your pathway, otherwise that is well invested to figure it out. We, for example, decided to make very sure that our product would not be a medical device. And maybe at the very end of our life cycle, we will do that, but not right now. So we wanted to make clear that anything we would design or put in there was within the realm where we would be a health application, not a medical application. So, well, thank you for your attention, and I hope this was a little inspiring. I would love to have the discussion, and I think if it was live, I like much more to have this interaction and what people think, but hopefully I steer some good thoughts and some things.
Thank you so much, Sophia. That was amazing, inspiring. I really appreciate it. And thanks for your support of our program and your mentorship.